Welcome to the Spoolcast. Steph Hay joins Jared Spool in a discussion about content-first design. Steph will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 19 Conference October 27th through 29th in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. And now, here's Jared.
Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of the Spoolcast. I'm so glad you're joining us today. We're going to have a wonderful time because we have with us the amazing, the wonderful, the vivacious Stephanie Hay, who is literally one of my favorite people on the planet.
Now I'm crying.
No, don't cry. You probably don't know this, but Stephanie writes a lot of the content that goes into our marketing. She's been doing that for a while. We are extremely fortunate to have her do that. And this year, for the first time, we are having her do a workshop at the User Interface 19 conference, which is a little awkward because she's writing the content for the conference and at the same time she's doing a workshop at the conference. And so we're all learning how to do that. But it's working out fabulous. And I got to tell you, I'm really excited about her workshop. And we're going to talk about that today. Stephanie, how are you?
I am fantastic. How are you doing, Jared?
I am doing fantastic. So you are speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not yet. But you will be speaking at, see, now you've got me watching my words.
Sorry, my bad. That's what happens. I always hear that from people. They say, oh, I feel weird writing you an email or sending you my resume because you're a writer. But that's usually the reason why they're sending it to me in the first place. So
it's, good point.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm used to it.
I used to work with someone this years and years ago when I actually had a real job. I used to work with someone. It was a company where the culture happened on email. You know, everything happened through email. And a company of about 150 engineers, almost all of whom came from MIT, and they're all very bright, very smart. And what was interesting was they had obnoxious writing skills. And what would happen is they would start to get into arguments or they'd get very passive aggressive in the writing. And there was a tech writer who worked amongst us who would, in a very sort of politically sensitive way, she would take an email that you've written and rewrite it and send it back to you and say, this is another way you could have said what you said.
Let me help you learn how to communicate.
Let me help you learn this. It was brilliant. I can't actually remember who it was. I just remember that there was somebody who did that. It was very funny. That was also many years ago. But that's not what we came to talk about today. What we came to talk about today is content-first design, which is an approach to design that I first heard from you. And you're going to do a full-day workshop on this at the conference. And I want to know, what is content-first design?
I'm super excited to be giving that full-day workshop because most of the time that I've ever talked about it, it's been in these half-day sessions, which ultimately end with me wanting to get into a little more detail in each section. So it's going to be the first time I get to dig into specific aspects of it that I've done with clients that I haven't had a chance to do before. So everybody who comes is going to get the greatest experience ever, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Well, good. I'll make sure that the copy promises that.
Good.
When you say content first design, what do you actually mean by that?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I learned very quickly and when I started working in the web, it was 2003. I had just moved to Washington, D.C. I was out of grad school from Ohio, and I was working in a College of Arts and Sciences, and we were managing 30 different departmental websites. And there was no centralized content management system. There were lots of different content managers all based in these different departments. They all had different ideas about the voice and tone and look and feel of their sites and that sort of thing. And one of the things I started realizing back then was how important it was to each of these people that there be a specific presence, you know, a certain look and feel, but not actually any content that said anything. So they were basically just regurgitating the PDFs of the course curriculum and that sort of thing. And we were in charge of sort of redesigning these websites. And I would always find that at the last minute, you know, 20 new pages of content would show up, and they were all coming from PDFs, and it was sort of a copy and paste effort. And it was a big fire, and everybody had to put it out so that we could launch on time. But ultimately, it never cut down on the number of calls into the admissions office or into the department, even if they redesigned their website, because the content itself wasn't giving the student or the parent who was calling anything else of value. It was just a new look for the website. So I wondered early on whether or not, this was like back in 2004, 2005, whether or not we would actually be more successful in communicating with students and their parents if we just put the PDFs online, because we weren't giving them anything else anyway, and they were getting tripped up in different problems with the websites themselves. So it was sort of a seed back then that developed further when I started working for agencies in the same exact pattern was continually emerging. We would focus a lot on design, and that's aesthetics. And then, you know, 2008, 2009 became much more about user experience design. So then we started introducing wireframes, and we started getting into hierarchy, and then content management systems were ubiquitous. So we started thinking about the, you know, taxonomy and that sort of thing and adaptive content, but we still weren't getting into the words themselves. Those were always at the very end. And in fact, most of the time, a designer was charged with writing the content in a traditional web development process because the client wasn't doing it, or there wasn't a copywriter on staff or something along those lines. So often whatever was in the comp would translate to the final product or to the near final product. And then the stakeholder would come in and actually look at the site, say, none of this content is right. And then we would go through the fire drill again. So this is a sort of pattern that I'd seen over the last 10 years across different organizations. And when I went into consulting for myself, I started pitching this idea of letting me start writing content first, actual content that would be in the final product and that stakeholders could look at in the first several weeks, and that we could build a design around. So I had a couple really great clients who were willing to cooperate with that and go through the growing pains of trying to do a completely new process that started with a Google Doc and content and no design until the first several pages of content were already completed. So the sitemap was born from content. The design was born from content. And it was a really sort of monumental shift in traditional web development process, but ultimately gave the clients and I and the teams I was working with a common language because we could all read the thing. We didn't have to have a specialty in UX design to really understand it. I mean, we all were able to communicate about what we were trying to say to our end users. And that's been the sort of focus of my work over the last 2 years in particular that's been truly rewarding.
So this idea is that you boil down by sort of thinking about the user's needs just by focusing on the content you're going to provide them at first. And then you start to ask the question, well, what does the rest of the design of the website or the app or whatever it is need to be to support this critical content? Versus building out this app and having these gray shaded wireframe boxes that says content goes here.
Exactly.
But you don't actually know if the content will fit there.
And often that was the case, is that designs would be over-engineered to enable any kind of content or multiple types of content in various positions in the real estate of a UI. But in reality, who was going to produce that content? And was there a need for it? And of course, you know, content strategy certainly has a role in trying to minimize these by coming up with governance plans and that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, is it realistic for the client? And so what I started focusing on instead of, you know, what can the client maintain from a governance perspective, to what does the user or customer actually ask for? So I typically would go into these different organizations and say, what are the top three questions that you receive on a regular basis? And it's crazy because these organizations can just rattle them off. They can rattle off five or six. And I'll say, where are these questions answered right now on your website? And 50% of the time, they didn't have an answer because it was some sort of, you know, well, we don't really like to answer it directly because, you know, XYZ, well, we don't really provide the best answer in the first place. You know, we don't want to give them bad news or whatever. So there was that sort of like business level thing. But the other 50% of the time, it was just, it was in a place that didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense to the user anyway, which is why they were getting the question. And I think that's where over-engineering comes into play from a content perspective. If you create these verticals and taxonomies and navigation systems that are too heady, you know, what makes sense to me doesn't necessarily make sense to you. So instead of coming up with the categories first, what if we wrote the content first and let those define the categories? Now, writing the content, of course, takes time, but what's the difference if we take the time, the 3 weeks up front, to write the first, you know, 5 or 10 pages of full content that really drive the entire reason why 75% of the people are coming to the site in the first place, or letting that 3 weeks wait until the end when now we've got all these different structures in place that we can't work around?
Yeah, I was going to say, you're basically buying time at the end by investing it up front.
That's right. And what the cool thing is, and frankly, I didn't anticipate this, but early on, what the cool thing is about that is the stakeholders are able to participate very early in those crucial first few weeks of a project, where normally we say, let's get together, let's have a kickoff meeting, let's all talk about these things. We're going to go away and generate some wireframes or some mood boards or something like that, right? And then you come back and you're like, here's some sort of, you know, traditional web industry document that isn't in your domain expertise. And now I'm asking you to give me some informed feedback on it. And it's like, you know, if I had to go to a television expo, you know, where all these TVs are on display and was told, like, here's a bunch of TVs. Now, you said that you wanted a TV. Here's a bunch of TVs. Which one do you like? I mean, there's no way I would be able to make a distinction between one or another. And that's one of the things that I've really learned with this content first UX design is that we are all looking at written document. We're all looking at the words that we would use to communicate with a customer or a user. And it allows everybody in the room to communicate. We all have this shared language. It's written English. It's not a wireframe. Nobody has to be educated on it. We say, hey, if you go to the homepage is going to say this. And the about page is going to say this. Or a product page is going to say this. And as they go through the checkout process, it's going to say this. We're going to ask for these pieces of information. And when they get an email after they've made a purchase, it's going to say this. And this is going to be the subject line. It's like everybody can have that conversation.
I assume that discussions of what the voice and the tone of this stuff comes out at this stage when you're talking about this.
That's right. Which, of course, then drives design choices as well.
Right. Because if you have a very sort of happy-go-lucky tone, you don't want the structure of the site to look like it's coming from a bank. But if you have a very formal tone, you don't want it to be, you know, cheery, happy, bubbly images.
That's right. And at the same time, like, who is the voice and tone? I mean, the voice and tone obviously represents the company that you're making the design for, but it's speaking to a user. And what is the language that the user uses, right? Or the customer uses? That becomes part of the discussion too, which I think makes for a healthier conversation from a user experience perspective, because it actually introduces the user as part of the original conversation versus waiting until there's usability testing once there's an actual site and it's sort of focused on functionality and finding stuff.
Yep. Well, that's really cool. So you've been doing this now for a few years with some of your clients. And is there some resistance that you run into at first, or do you have to sort of get over some objections, or is this one of these things where you sort of explain it to them, they go, of course, that's exactly how we should do it, and just it smoothly sails through the organization with no conflict at all?
I'll tell you a couple stories. I'll say all of the above. It's completely, you know, environmentally driven. So I was working with the Annie Casey Foundation, and John Hodgkins, their communication manager there, a fantastic guy. Really early on, he was open-minded to this idea, but also he comes from a digital background enough to understand that this was atypical. And, you know, I don't really make any bones about it or anything either. You know, that wasn't part of the initial discussion. It was just sort of like, hey, this is what we're going to work on for the next few weeks. So we should be on a phone call every single week. I'm going to give you assignments. You're going to have to write content. I'm going to write some content to help you, to sort of give you a guide, jumping off point, so to speak. And so he said, I want to say it was probably our second call. The first call was a little stiff, right? Because I'm saying, what is the most important page on your site? Now we can look at analytics and see what is the most sought after content. And we can also, from an organization perspective, you know, get that answer from someone like John, who says, well, our reports, you know, we're a foundation, we provide grants, we do research to figure out the impact of these grants. And so the research are distilled into these reports. So people come to the reports pages to learn what we've learned. And so we immediately found out that in their existing reports pages, they didn't have any real quote unquote conversion points of, you know, can you download the report? Can you provide an email address if you want to learn more about this particular topic, that sort of thing. So we were all on a call together discussing what they could do from a content perspective to give people who landed on these pages in the new site some sort of next step, some way of showing that they didn't just read this, you know, they weren't just another number on the analytics, but they actually wanted to do something with it. So that first call was really already digging into the purpose of the site. From a content perspective, what do we want them to do? What are the actions that they're going to take? By the way, these are going to be the labels on buttons eventually, you know? So after that first call, then we went up a higher level. Okay, how does somebody get to this report page in the first place? Let's write the content on a higher level page that would lead somebody to a report page, that sort of thing. And he said to me afterwards, you know, after the first call, I sort of got where you were going with this, but it was really hard seeing this blank page in front of me because we're all working in a Google Doc. I mean, the same Google Doc. This is where we make our comments. All of the content for the website is in a Google Doc, a very long one. He says, but then once I started getting into it, I totally got it. And then it became part of my work week. But it was, you know, again, shifting your thinking away from, well, can't we just deal with the content later after we've done all the design, to the content is the whole reason for the design in the first place. So I've got to do the hard work now. And so he was an example of somebody who sort of, you know, after going through one session, got it and started running with it. And then he had a whole team. And at that point, I was just basically a guide. I was hardly doing anything. They embraced it. They went bananas to put together even a style guide to bring on more content managers to help out, because this was something they could all do. While the website, while the design was being done, they were all writing content. It was great. But then, you know, on the other side, there are some, like a law firm I was working with, they had a content manager who, they totally got it, but organizationally speaking, there were lots of levels of approvals of people who didn't really understand this approach, and they wanted to see the design first, which reminds me a lot of the way that it was 10 years ago when I was at George Mason, where there's nothing wrong with wanting to see design. I mean, design is fun. Being able to make choices about what you like to look at on your own website is fine. It's totally fine. But for me, in my particular focus, I'm about improving the communication between the customer and the organization, which happens, of course, with design. But for me, it happens through word and word choice and a hierarchy of those words. So the content first design approach sort of strips everything else out. And it takes the kind of organization who is very content focused to understand that and really embrace it.
Are there certain types of organizations or certain types of projects where this content-first approach really lends itself, and certain types of projects where it's just not the right approach?
So what I found is it seems to really just be culturally driven. If people recognize that content, and even organizations like Dell, for example, say content marketing is really important, but that the content is the most important piece and are willing to embrace a content-first approach, it'll work for anybody. It doesn't matter what they're doing. So I've worked on this with startups to define exactly what that end-to-end experience is going to be. Somebody comes to you and has to do some sort of transaction, you know, a sign-up or whatever it might be. I've used it for product design. For those same startups, beyond their marketing site, what happens when somebody actually uses their application? What's the way that we entice them to give us an input? And then what do they get in response? This is getting into micro copy. And then, like I said, like with an Annie Casey, I mean, this is a huge content heavy website. We've used it to guide the experience that, you know, 50% plus of their monthly visitors are going to have. So I don't think it necessarily depends on, you know, what the product or service is, as much as it depends on the people being willing to prioritize content and prioritize the work of talking through the conversation that needs to happen between them and their users.
So when we were going over the outline for the workshop, one of the things that came up was you mentioned this thing called a language board. And I realized I don't actually know what that is.
Yeah. Have you heard of Style Tiles by Samantha Warren?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Style Tiles are these lovely single page abstractions of the colors and the fonts and some of the way the layout will look in such a way that you can get feedback from a client without them critiquing, well, that paragraph of text doesn't actually reflect what we're going to be talking about.
Exactly. Well, this is what a language board does. And the same idea, it becomes a communication tool, except the language board really focuses on combining the language that customers use with the language that the organization feels comfortable using. So, you know, they typically see like an editorial style guide or a style voice and tone guide, and it normally comes up at the end of a project. And this is, again, flipping that paradigm. A language board takes the top search terms that bring people to a company's website because that represents their language, the way that they think about the world, right?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And it has the terms that are the way that the organization categorizes or talks about those same kinds of terms. And I use residence hall and dorm as the example there, right? People search dorms on the university's website, but the university has everything under residence halls. This is a problem because they have data to indicate that people don't think about them as residence halls. So we can have the discussion early on about how much the organization wants to quote unquote educate slash force the user into their language paradigm versus being able to embrace what their customers or users' natural language is. The language board really, if you think about it in terms of, again, like as a Google Doc, as an outline of the customer and the customer's voice mixed with, you know, the organization's content goals and the voice of that content, it serves as a foundation through which we can then comfortably write conversations that speak to both of their languages.
That sounds really useful.
I think it is.
That's good.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I really was inspired by with Samantha's Style Tiles. It's not so much the product itself. It's the fact that it can create a conversation around what's most meaningful. And in the case of, you know, when I'm working on content all the time, it's whether or not the words that we're using are landing. You know, do they mean anything to the customer? Are we speaking the same language? And the companies and organizations who are willing to evolve to meet their customers in a conversation, in a comfortable conversation, tend to have higher engagement. And they also tend to create ongoing content that has higher engagement.
That makes perfect sense to me. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot lately about the difference between what I would call a deliverable versus an artifact. And a deliverable is something you hand to the client, you know, it's the final copy, it's the rough draft, it's something that is sort of going to denote that we've hit this milestone at this time and the project is moving forward. Whereas an artifact is something that you give that really only has meaning in that moment. And down the road won't be that useful. It's a sketch or a style tile. Though a style tile could be both an artifact and a deliverable because once it's finalized, you can use it for a bunch of things. But the language board sounds like it at least also plays this role of an artifact. And an artifact is something which is really about, hey, I'm going to give this to you just to get your feedback. You know, if I was cooking a soup, I might give you a taste out of the pot and say, what do you think? And you might say, I think it needs more salt. And that's an artifact versus the deliverable of the soup, which is, here's your bowl of soup, enjoy this. And I think there's something to that. And it's not a conversation I hear us talking about very much.
And it also is at a point, I want your feedback early on before we've started to involve more people in the process. You know, from a design perspective, we start getting deeper into it. The words are like the lowest fidelity thing. I mean, we're working in a Google Doc, okay? This is a lowest fidelity thing. So what ends up happening is, for example, I was working with Custom Ink, which is this awesome t-shirt screen printing company here locally around DC. And early on, you know, they have a sort of light, sort of happy-go-lucky language, voice and tone. And I wrote the word awesome, and they said, we would never use the word awesome. So even me as somebody who is a customer of theirs and was working with them from a consulting standpoint, didn't completely interpret who they were yet, but they knew who they were. And the language board is the way, you know, we can sort of have those conversations early on before things are really set.
So this is how you discover that a client's not awesome.
We don't use the word awesome. It's more like, you know, well, they have really lovely language, but awesome is just not part of their language, you know? It's part of mine.
It's always struck me that awesome, right, is some awe, whereas awful is not full of awe.
Yeah, no. That's funny. You ever see that Gallagher skit when Gallagher used to talk about these things?
No.
All right. I'm going to find it and I'll send you the link.
Oh, wow. Okay. We'll have to put it in the show notes. Do I have to wear a tarp?
No.
I was afraid to fire up Gallagher videos because I'm afraid I'm going to get watermelon all over me.
George Carlin did stuff like this too, actually.
Oh, playing with words. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So while we're playing with words, another thing that we talked about, which I realized I didn't quite know what we were talking about, was a conversation map.
Yeah. So the conversation map is what emerges from this content-first UX design approach. And what it is the structure itself. So in the example of Anna E. Casey, I said, we started with a page. There's no structure to this. There's no map. There's no journey. There's a single page. Somebody ultimately wants to end here. So let's start with that. That's the highest value page, the most sought after content. Once we've done that, we said, okay, how does somebody get here? Well, they would most likely come through, if we think about it as a conversation, right? Well, this is the way that the conversation would sort of roll out. So we go up a higher level and we continue doing that until we arrive at the entry point of the conversation, which is usually the homepage. So the conversation map, it's backwards, it's a little backwards. We're starting with the highest value content, which is typically not on the homepage. It's typically some, right now, second or third level page, and we want to actually have that conversation. So we write that content first, and then we take a step back and we write the content of what would lead into that high sought after content page. And we continue moving backward in the process until we've mapped a conversation from entry point. Hi, who are you? Well, we're Anna E. Casey Foundation. What do you do? Well, we work with juvenile justice. And what do you know about juvenile justice? Well, all of this research here. So we end up architecting, let's say, at minimum three, sometimes four or five different pages of content that forms the structure of one potential path. And typically this is the majority of users who come will go in through some sort of path like this. This creates the map. At this point, now it's about repeating it. Can we do this again? It's like choose your adventure books, right? What are the other ways that somebody could navigate, and I use that word lightly here, this conversation? What are some other topics in this conversation that would lead them to a different point? And what is the content when they arrive there? So this conversation map ends up being the product and the structure of writing 5, 10, 15 pages of content that we know should exist, and then finding out how it pulls together. And so we're mapping that content, which ends up creating the site map.
Okay. So this is how we then start to get into the actual design, is we have this conversation map, which then becomes the site map, which then becomes the structure of the site. And between that and some of the pages and the content that we've created, we now know what the words have to be on the page, which means we can then create the design that will contain those words, and we're off.
That's exactly right. A couple of questions that I get on a regular basis about this sort of approach are, number one, what if you don't have a product yet? Because the process I just gave you, I'm using Anna E. Casey as an example, was existing content, right? So if you've got existing content, how do you go about this process? But if you don't have anything yet, if you're a startup, the content map would really work as a conversation itself. So somebody says to me, oh, I've got a new idea. It's like Flickr for YouTube, whatever that is, okay? I'm like, okay, what's that mean? And I continue to document what they're telling me until we figure out what it is that the actual conversation is going to be that helps me understand what this product is, what I'm supposed to do with it, how I interact with it, that sort of thing. So you can start from the very beginning, from that entry point. Tell me who it is you are, what it is that you offer me, what problem do you solve, that sort of thing. So in that case, the content map functions much more like documenting how the conversation should roll out from start to finish. And that's really the only difference in the activity is just where do we start? If there's existing content, we work backwards from the most important content up. If there's no content already, we just map the conversation how it should exist. And then after it launches, we look 3-4 months later and figure out what is the most sought after content from the conversation we've just produced. And if we want to refine it at that point, we work backwards.
That's brilliant. That's great. I am so excited about this workshop.
Yeah.
I'm going to learn so much. This is such a great way of thinking about designing all sorts of things. So this is going to be awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited about it. And I will say too, like, one of the most rewarding parts of having given this workshop a couple times already is that there's always this moment of epiphany where product managers and designers and developers, like, I always say developers get such a bad rep because they, quote unquote, you know, don't know how to write microcopy or something. But I think that's such a crock because who is writing it for them, right? At some point, there's an error that has to be thrown. And so it says, sorry, you made an error. And then after the site launches, someone comes back to them and says, hey, you're making the user feel like it's their fault. This is where the content first approach really comes into play, is that I've already thought about what that error should be because I've walked through the conversation that I want to have with the user, including what are the labels on the fields. So there's always this epiphany that happens in the workshops when people realize that they have to think about that stuff now. It's not somebody else's responsibility down the road. So for example, like we will in this workshop, if we walk through a transaction and I say, okay, billing or shipping, you know, I make them think through the billing and shipping addresses and what they need and how could that be a simpler process? And what happens if they don't put something in? What's the error message that we should show and how should we show it? Because in a conversation map where we're starting to document all of this stuff, that's where using something like a Google Doc makes a lot of sense, is because you can just leave a comment there. You say, well, we're going to have address fields. Well, no, you can't just say we have address fields. You got to say exactly what fields you want, because we're writing down the labels so the developer doesn't have to think about it, or the designer doesn't have to think about it, and the developer doesn't have to think about it.
Right. Is it a zip code? Is it a postal code?
That's right. That's right. So there's always this epiphany where it's like, oh, I'm the one doing the work. It's like, that makes the designer's life. I remember like Patrick Marseille at HappyCog. I asked him after we went through a project together like this, I said, was this really helpful at all for you? You know, because I sort of led that. And he worked with us on all of the calls and everything. And he said, I don't ever want to work without this again. It made his life easier. And as a result, it made everyone else's lives easier by thinking about those detailed messages and words up front.
Yep. Makes perfect sense. Steph, this has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, thank you very much, Jared. I'm really excited for October.
Yeah. And for those of you listening, you really want to catch Steph's full day workshop on content first design. It's going to be at the User Interface 19 conference, which is going to be October 27th through 29th. And we are so excited to have her there to talk about this for the day. And I know I'm going to learn a ton, and I know you are too. So you want to come and do that. Thank you, Steph, for talking to us.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. And of course, thank you for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you next time. Take care.
For more information about Steph's and the other 7 workshops, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. As always,